I'll start. I'm very happy to take questions, of course, during those lectures. So just interrupt, especially with such a small number of people, it really is good to interrupt. If you don't understand anything. So what I want to do today is I want to start working towards talking about how you can derive quantum theory from sort of sets of more reasonable axioms. But I thought a good warm-up exercise would be to talk about the shape of quantum state space. So already I talked a bit about this the last time I spoke to you. So remember, if you have a spin half particle, that's equivalent to this object. There's a linear relationship between these two objects. And furthermore, we discussed how the space that these states live in, it's kind of a cone with a sphere on top, or a ball on top. And if we just look at the top of the cone, this is at the origin, the vector 0. And then here, if we look at this space where we impose the condition, that the state is normalized, then the state lives, it's a cube that lives inside this, the sphere, or the ball, that lives inside this unit cube. So any point on or inside this sphere is an allowed state, an allowed normalized state. And then all the states which are proportional to that going down to the origin are also allowed. So that's the set of allowed states. Is that clear? This is where I left off last time. Okay. Furthermore, the states that are on the surface of this ball, any point on the sphere, is a pure state. And any state on the inside is a mixed state. Just to formalize that, a mixed state is a state that can be written like this. So you can take imagine you take a coin, and with probability lambda, it comes up heads, and you prepare this state. With probability 1 minus lambda, it comes up tails, and you prepare that state. So the probabilities that you have are the convex combinations. That just means I weight it with lambda and 1 minus lambda of the probabilities inside these vectors. So a state is mixed if you can write it like this for some lambda that's not equal to 0 or 1. You can see the states that are on the surface here cannot be written like that, whereas the states that are on the interior can be written like that. So in the case of the Bloch sphere, this is the Bloch sphere, in the case of a qubit or a spin half particle, all the states that are on the surface of this object are pure states. Now, what about in general? What about for general dimensional systems? So imagine you have a density matrix like this. So this is for an n-dimensional Hilbert space. I can't remember if I did this last time or not, the counting for an n-dimensional Hilbert space. I don't think I did. No. And then over here you have off-diagonal terms. Like so. So this is going to be equivalent to some set of probabilities. Okay, so some set of probabilities are going to be equivalent to this. There's going to be a linear relationship. For the moment, I'm just interested in how many probabilities there are. And so it's just going to be the number of real parameters inside this matrix. And you can count. So the number of real parameters inside here, k, is equal to, well, you have n probabilities down the diagonal. And then above the diagonal, you have n. N times n minus 1 over 2 terms. And each of these is complex, so it contributes to real parameters. And then the terms below the diagonal are just the complex conjugates of the ones above, so you don't get any more contributions there. So this is the number of real parameters in a dimension, in a density matrix corresponding to a system of dimension n. Was n squared. Okay. It's interesting that it's crucial here that you have complex numbers to get this simple form. If we had real numbers here, you'd just have a 1, then you'd get something different. If you had quaternions, again, you'd get something different. So the fact that we have real numbers, so complex numbers in quantum theory, is playing a role. Okay, so so that's the number of real, that's basically the dimension of the state space for a general state. What's the dimension of the boundary of the state space? Well, it's just going to be one less than that. The dimension of the boundary let's be careful. Let's first of all talk about the normalized states. They have dimension n squared minus 1, because you have one equation giving you the normalization. And then the boundary of the set of states is n squared minus 2. So you can see in the case where n is equal to 2, the boundary is just the surface of the ball. So it's two-dimensional. But what about the what is the dimension of the set of pure states? Let's call it L. Anyone know what that is equal to? Dimension of the set of pure states, an n-dimensional system in quantum theory. So, yeah.
2n, 2n minus 1, depending.
A state is given, a pure state is given by like that. And then here you get, these are all complex numbers, so you get 2n of them, 2n real numbers. But then you actually have two constraints, really, two extra constraints. So one is normalization, which provides one equation, so that gives you 2n minus 1. But then also you don't care about the overall phase as well. So that's 2n minus 2. Okay. So for a qubit, this gives you 2 times 2 minus 2. It gives you 2, which is what we knew the answer had to be. It's the same as the dimension of the surface of the ball. But in this case, these two numbers are equal. But in general, they're not equal. And so in general, the dimension of the pure states is less. And as n increases, much less than the dimension of the boundary. So what that means is, first of all, it means that this example is very misleading, quite different from the general case. It means that the boundary of the set of states for general dimensional systems has places where mixed states live. As well as there being places where pure states live. And it's kind of difficult to visualize because, we can't draw pictures that are above this dimension. But here's here's an example of a convex object that has this kind of property, just to give us something to visualize. This isn't quantum theory, but it's sort of just an example. So imagine you take a circle. Okay, and then you softly bend it. Okay, so this is going to test my artistic ability. So I'm going to softly bend this circle. So I've taken the circle and I've bent it. And now I'm going to take what's called the convex hull of the states in here. So I'm going to join. I'm going to fill in all the. So hoping this picture makes as much sense to you as it makes to me. So I've taken the circle, I've bent it softly, and now I'm going to take all the mixed states that are generated by the set of pure states. Okay, so all the states in between here. So here's an example where we have the set of pure states live on a surface of dimension 1. Whereas the boundary states are on a surface of dimension 2. And so in particular, there are states on the surface that are mixed states. So this just starts to give you some insight into the sort of nature of this quantum state space. It's not a simple object. It's difficult to visualize exactly what it is. So people have written a lot about the shape of Hilbert space, of states that live act on Hilbert space. Let me just say one more thing about this. The one thing you can do is you can see that if you have a convex set, then it's fully characterized by saying what the extremal states are, what the pure states are. If you know the pure states, then you can just join all those together to make all the mixed states. So if you can characterize the set of pure states, then you have some insight into the shape of Hilbert space. The shape of state space. So in quantum theory, states are given by density matrices. And we know that these density matrices correspond to pure states if they have only one eigenvalue and it's equal to one. Okay. Another way of stating that condition is that the density matrix is equal to its own square. We take this to be an emission matrix, and then we check its square, check it's equal to its own square, and then this tells us, if this is true, these are states are pure. And here we have n squared equations. And they're quadratic in the entries, because this is a square, so any matrix elements will get squared in here. And remember, the matrix elements are linear in probability. So here we have a set of n squared equations which are quadratic in probabilities. Is that clear? Yep. There's another interesting way of characterizing the set of pure states. And interestingly, this wasn't discovered, in spite of its simplicity, until 2004. in a paper by Jones and Linden. And even then, in this paper, it wasn't given a central role. It was just an obscure point made, I think, even in an appendix, or at least in the details of some proof of something else. So it was Chris Fuchs who kind of rescued this result from obscurity. And he talks about it in some of his papers. And so the condition for a state rho to be pure . We're assuming that rho is Hermitian, which is a very simple property to check. You just look at the entries of the matrix. Now, condition for it to be pure is that the trace of rho squared is equal to the trace of rho cubed, equals one. So this is interesting. This is just, here we have only two equations rather than n squared equations. So the number of equations here doesn't scale the dimension of the Hilbert space. And these equations are cubic because we have rho cubed here. So if we were to insert probabilities into this, we would get cubes of probabilities. Sorry, well, we actually have a cubic equation here and a quadratic equation here. So we have So those two equations give you the space of states. I've got to say this shape, when you bend this, a former Psi student named this the Pringle. Because it's sort of like a Pringle, and then if you join all the points around the rim of the Pringle into a convex hull, this is what you get. Okay. It's interesting to compare this with the classical case, because you can also characterize the pure states for classical probability theory with just two equations, two polynomial equations. Guess I'll go here. So here's here's a classical TRIT, a three-level system. Here are the extremal states. These are the pure states. There's only three of them. And you can characterize those pure states by two polynomial equations. But the sum of the probabilities is equal to one. That gives you this sheet. And then also that the sum of the probabilities squared equals one. And that gives you a sphere which intersects the sheet at these three points in the positive quadrant. You do here have to say that the probabilities are greater than zero, greater than or equal to zero. Whereas in this case, you don't have to say that. Anyway, it's always struck me that this is a very interesting result, but I don't really know what to do with it. It seems like one could get a lot more out of this result than people have. It contains some potentially deep insights. Okay. So now I want to start the story of reconstruction. So the point of this interlude was just to see that we're talking about some kind of very strange object. The quantum state space is a strange object. It'd be nice if we could find a way to reconstruct it, not just the quantum state space, but the whole of quantum theory. So the space of transformations and the space of measurement as well. So let's start that story. So the real question here is why is quantum theory the way it is? John Wheeler asked the question, why the quantum? John Wheeler had two questions that were, well, he had lots of questions, of course, but he had two questions that are relevant for this course. So one question was, why is there something rather than nothing? Which is a very difficult question to answer. I don't even know how to begin to answer a question like that. And then his other question, which is more tractable, although still difficult, is why the quantum? Well, I would expand it as why is quantum theory the way it is? And that's a difficult question to know how to answer too. But at least we can look at some sort of past examples. So we might have asked why. Why Kepler's laws? So Kepler had these laws of planetary motion. Three laws of planetary motion. Yeah, so one of them was that planets sweep out equal areas in equal times. A given planet sweeps out equal areas in equal times. Another law was to do with the relationship between the period of the planet and its distance from the sun. And the other one was that the planets will move around the sun in ellipsoidal motion, so an ellipse motion, with the sun at one of the focal points. So those laws of motion were very good and very predictive when it came to planetary motion, but of course they were completely obscure. Why on earth would you choose those particular laws? And the answer to that question came from Newton with his three laws of mechanics. Plus one law of gravitation. And so with this three law, with this structure, he was able to explain why these things were true. and actually do a lot more, of course. So even in the context of heavenly bodies, he was able to explain the motion of say comets moving on a parabolic orbit, not just ellipsoidal. Also, from Newton's laws, you can see that these different planets perturb each other, so that would show deviation from Kepler's laws. So Newton's laws provided an explanation as to why Kepler's laws were true, and these laws are somehow more intuitive. You know, the laws of mechanics, they seem like sort of reasonable statements you might think were true in physics, whereas these are just completely ad hoc. They seem to come from nowhere. And furthermore, once you've got this, then you can go beyond Kepler's laws, and ultimately you can go beyond even Newton's laws into general relativity and so on. And another nice example, historical example, is why the Lorentz transformations. So it was already known before Einstein came along that Maxwell's equations were invariant under this set of transformations, but they were an odd-looking set of transformations. They had the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared in them. So from a mathematical point of view, they seem much stranger than the Galilean transformations. And in the case of the Galilean transformations, there was a perfectly natural explanation for them. You just add velocities. So the Galilean transformations seemed intuitive and reasonable, whereas these ones seemed unintuitive and ad hoc. And it's similar to the case for between quantum theory and classical probability theory. So classical probability theory seems intuitive and reasonable. The state space you get and everything, there are perfectly good reasons for it, just like Galilean transformations. However, in the case of Galilean transformations, once you understand the reasons for the Lorentz transformations, the Einstein's postulates, Einstein's two postulates, then suddenly the Lorentz transformations seem more reasonable, and the Galilean transformations seem like they're wrong. But you need to have the explanation, the two postulates that Einstein provided. And of course, once you've got this, then you're in a position to go beyond special relativity onto a theory of general relativity. So the question is, can we do something similar for quantum theory? Now, if you look at quantum theory, it's kind of ad hoc. The state space is given by these operators acting on a complex Hilbert space. So why a Hilbert space? Why a complex Hilbert space? Evolution is given by unitary transformations, or more generally by completely positive maps. So why those objects? Why the tensor product as a way of combining systems? And so on, all these questions. So, can we do something over here as a way of explaining why quantum theory is the way it is? And if we can do that, then maybe we'll be in a position to go beyond quantum theory, perhaps to a theory of quantum gravity. So that would be the ultimate goal here. By now, there's quite a lot of people who've worked on different sets of postulates in which you can derive quantum theory. I'm going to present my own set of postulates from 2001. Maybe not today, maybe tomorrow. But I want to begin just by setting up the sort of the framework in which you can have a set of postulates. You know, in all these different cases, before you can write down postulates, you need some kind of framework. Sometimes the framework is sort of implicit. You know, so Einstein is assuming that there's this sort of this possibility of having sort of global inertial coordinate system with points labeled by some number of parameters corresponding to space and time. It's not clear he actually questioned that in the first place when he set up this framework. But nevertheless, that was there in the background. So here, before we can impose postulates, we need some kind of framework within which we can impose postulates. So the framework I want to present is this operational framework, sometimes called a general probability theories. It's a framework in which you can calculate probabilities. So here's how it works. So imagine you go into a laboratory and you look at a quantum experiment. A quantum experiment is built out of all sorts of different pieces of apparatus. And we can imagine the pieces of apparatus, that's just something like this. So you have pieces of apparatus that have holes in them corresponding to places quantum systems can come into or go out of. Maybe there's some holes on the bottom here too. They can have knob settings, things that you can adjust to different positions. And they can have outcomes, for example, lights that can flash different colors, red, green, or blue, for example. So this is a piece of apparatus. Now, the thing about a piece of apparatus is it's just something in a laboratory. And, you know, you can do anything with it, like you could kick it. You could smash it with a hammer. But if you're going to use this piece of apparatus in a way, you know, that's useful, then we want to prescribe the way in which we use it. And so set up the notion of an operation. So for an operation, what we do is we say, well, certain of these apertures correspond to inputs, and we're going to send certain types of quantum system into them. Okay, so here I have two types of quantum system, A and B. So A could be an electron, B could be a photon. So we have some number of systems go in, some number of systems go out. These numbers don't have to match because there could inside here be a source, for example, of electrons. You can even have entirely different systems at the top and at the bottom. And of course, the numbers of systems also don't have to match because stuff could be happening inside this box. What we're doing here is we're imposing a constraint on the way you use this piece of apparatus, which is that you only send electrons into this input and photons into this one. Furthermore, here, when we define this operation, we want to choose a particular setting, okay, and that's taken to be implicit in the notation A, and also a particular outcome. So here we had red, blue, or green. So if we just choose, say, the red outcome, then that's taken. So that would define an operation. So that's taken to be implicit in this notation too. So if we had a different outcome, for example, then we'd use a different symbol here. Instead of using A, we might use B. A prime or something. This prescription is called an operation. once we have an operation, then we can wire them together to make circuits. Here's an example of a circuit. You might have noticed I'm trying to do a different font here. There's a reason for that. This is meant to be sans serif, math sans serif font. When you wire together these circuits, there's a couple of rules. The one rule is that you have to match the outputs of inputs. You cannot send a system of type A into from an output into an input for a system of type B. Okay. So you shouldn't send electrons into photon inputs. The other rule is that you want there to be no closed loops as you trace forward. So there's kind of implicit arrows on these wires because the boxes have an orientation. So the top of the box, arrows from the top of the box go to the bottom of the box. So I could, in principle, draw an arrow on here, but it's not necessary because you can see from the box structure where the arrows, which way the arrows would point. But if I trace forward along the arrows, we want to make it so we don't get back to where we started. So, for example, so this would be forbidden. So we don't allow these closed loops. Graphs like this are called, in the literature, they're called directed acyclic graphs. So directed because there are arrows on these wires. Acyclic because you're not allowed to have any circles like this. And G because they're graphs, or DAGs for short.
The directed acyclic graph?
Yeah. Okay. Did you just look it up on the internet?
No.
Okay.
Well, kind of know the term for some reason.
Okay. So the kind of thing we're going to be interested in is calculating the probability of these circuits. So you can see each of these boxes has an outcome, or can have an outcome specified. Okay, even the first one, even the preparation box at the beginning. So there could be lights on each of these boxes. So imagine this one has a red light associated with this A. This one could be a green light, a yellow light, another red light. We want to know what the joint probability is for all of those lights flashing. And that's the kind of thing that quantum theory can calculate for us. But at this stage, we're interested in more general probabilistic theories. Is that clear? Okay. So yes, I want a mathematical framework which is good for calculating probabilities for these general circuits. But let's start with a simpler case. Let's start with simple circuits. We want to calculate the probability for a circuit like this. Okay, and here we have basically a preparation. And then also we have this thing, which is a measurement with also it has to have an outcome specified. So it's a measurement. With an outcome specified. And I've taken to calling these things results. I couldn't find a term in the literature for this thing where you specify also an outcome. So I'm calling that a result. So we have a measurement followed by a result. And we want to know how to calculate the probability for this kind of thing. Well, let's have associate with a preparation. I want to associate with a preparation a state. And a state is going to be some mathematical object that we can use to calculate the probability any circuit. Which has this preparation in it. One thing that's worth saying here is here this is a simple circuit in the sense that I have a preparation, the system passes through, and then I have a result. Now this box here could actually be composed of lots of different boxes that just have one input. So for example, B could be could actually be a much more complicated circuit, like this. But I think the important point is it only has one wire coming into it. So any circuit that has this preparation will have some structure like this. Okay. This is a very general situation that we're considering. Okay. Okay. Okay, well, what kind of mathematical object could we associate with a preparation that would allow us to calculate the probability for any circuit having that preparation? Well, here's one mathematical. Actually, one thing I should point out. When I say the probability of any circuit, important is this is the joint probability. So there could be an outcome here, like a red light that flashes, and here, a blue light that flashes. So we're interested in calculating the joint probability of this red light and this blue light flashing. Okay, so what is a mathematical object that we can use to calculate the probability for any circuit having this preparation? Well, here's one. We just list the probabilities for every circuit. So for every single result, we list the probability associated with having this preparation. But clearly, if we have this mathematical object, then we can calculate the probability for any circuit. It's really just a lookup table. Now, if physics were like that, it would be difficult to do. It wouldn't be very useful if physics just consisted of lookup tables for every possible situation. That would be a bit of a disaster. So what can we do that's a bit more efficient, a bit more convenient? Well, what we can do is we can say, let's compress this object using linear compression. I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. Down to a smaller object. So alpha here is in some subset, which I think I call, I don't remember what I call it, let's call it F. So here, what we're doing is we're just taking a subset of all these possible results to some more convenient subset in such a way there exists so in such a way that we can write. For a general result, for a general circuit, we can write this. This is an R. Let me write it up here. Okay. What we want is we want to be able to write a shorter list of probabilities such that a general probability is given by the dot product of some vector r associated with the result and some vector a associated with the preparation. And furthermore, we want to do that we want to have the shortest list of this sort. So this should be the P should have the fewest possible elements.
What's F?
What's sorry?
F alpha.
Oh, F is I chose F because it stands for fiducial. So it's a subset of all the possible results that you could have, measurements plus outcomes, which have the property that from this subset there exists an equation that you can calculate everything else. So you've already seen an example like this. In the case of quantum theory for a qubit, for a spin half particle, so in this case, F is equal to that set. Okay. The one thing about these fiducial sets is that they're not unique. You could make many different choices of fiducial set and still be able to do this. But they do have the property that any fiducial set that's chosen so it has the fewest possible elements, of course, has the same number of elements. So here in quantum theory, you could have, instead of choosing these directions, you could have chosen, for example, any other three orthogonal directions. Or in fact, actually, really pretty much any set of directions as long as they correspond to linearly independent states will work. Are there any more questions? Completely clear? Good. So in general, it's clear that we can always do this because in the worst case scenario, this list could just be equal to this one. So the worst case is where there are as many probabilities in this list as there are in this list. But in general, in physical theories, we get some kind of compression in the sense that there are relationships between quantities. So another question you might ask yourselves here is why is this compression, why make this compression linear? Could have instead, it could be that there exists that there exists some other form of compression which is better than linear compression. So why wouldn't I use that instead? Sort of erasing what I should be talking about here. Now, if it were the case, even in quantum theory, that you were going to restrict your states to be pure states, then there is a more efficient way of representing the state. It's the thing I was about to erase. This only requires 2n minus 2 real parameters. However, that's a very artificial restriction. In principle, in real experiments, it's very difficult to make sure all your states are pure. So if you allow your states to be mixed, then you can show that linear compression is optimal. If you allow arbitrary mixtures, then you can see that linear compression is optimal. And I'll show you that. You can also show, incidentally, that any optimal compression is necessarily linear, and I won't show you that, but it's straightforward. Okay, so I should say occasionally I use this term compression, and occasionally I run into difficulty here because this term compression is used in quantum information to have a more specific meaning. So what all I mean by compression is what I was saying here, that you use fewer parameters to specify the state. And you're using sort of, you know, the smallest number of parameters you can, smallest number of probabilities you can. Okay. So linear compression is optimal if allow arbitrary mixtures. So how do we prove this? Well, first of all, I know that. Okay, that's so an arbitrary mixture like this. So k, we take k to be the size of f. K is the number of elements in f. And then we take an arbitrary mixture where we what we do is we sort of toss a die or, you know, or whatever it is, and we, depending on the outcome we get, we prepare one of the states from this mixture. We choose our states. We choose this set of states to be linear independent. And we know that there are k such linearly independent states because we've made our compression optimal. Okay, if there were more, if there were fewer independent states than this, then we could have chosen fewer probabilities in our list of probabilities. The other thing is we want these probabilities that we prepare different states to be, obviously they have to be greater than zero, greater than or equal to zero. And we want the sum of these probabilities to be less than or equal to one. The reason I don't insist that the sum is necessarily equal to one is because we can always have an extra outcome here where we prepare, let me call it lambda zero, where we prepare this, I'm running out of space here, where we prepare the state zero. So now, if this is our space of states, then you can see, and really the point I'm making here is very trivial, you can see that you need, in order to characterize this set of mixed states, for this particular set, this set of mixed states, but we need k lambdas. So we need k real numbers. So that means that having a list of probabilities with k real numbers in it is to represent the state is optimal. You couldn't do better than that if you allow arbitrary mixtures. Just gone. Okay, well, it's quarter past 11. So I'll continue tomorrow, and I'll talk about, I'll set up this framework a little bit more. I'll talk about some interesting properties. So one particularly interesting property is called tomographic locality. There are a set of other properties, so I'll talk about that tomorrow. And then I'll give you a set of axioms or postulates that you can use to derive the quantum framework within this sort of framework I'm talking about.